Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. This decision, this process, will change your life. There was a man who changed Marcus Aurelius's life. His name was Quintus Junius Rusticus, a teacher who tirelessly urged his student to read attentively, not to be satisfied with just getting the gist of it. And what did he urge this student to read? Whose work did he recommend to this promising young man? Epictetus. Knowing all the power and responsibility that would soon come Marcus's way, Rusticus designed a course of study and reading that would prepare him as much as possible for the kind of thing you can never truly prepare for. Together, they would read and reread these lessons, absorbing and discussing, challenging and encouraging each other, which made them both better. Marcus could have blown this instruction off. He could have chased pleasure instead, but he didn't. He was a diligent and dedicated student. Interestingly enough, Dwight Eisenhower, who in turn would come to hold immense and in some cases absolute power, had a nearly identical influence in his own life. In 1922, as a lowly staff officer, Eisenhower was ordered to Panama to join the 20th Infantry Brigade, serving 2 years under General Fox Connor, a man Eisenhower later said had a place in my affections that no other, not a relative, could obtain. In the book General Fox Connor, Pershing's Chief of Operations and Eisenhower's Mentors, there is a passage about the relationship. Connor gradually led Eisenhower to a more advanced level of military study, the author writes. The general introduced his assistant to the writings of the 19th century Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz, whose On War remains an influential treatise on warfare. Eisenhower struggled to grasp the military maxims set forth by Clausewitz. So Connor had Eisenhower read the book 3 times to drive home the lessons. Connor would quiz Eisenhower as to what each Clausewitzian principle meant. In a 1966 letter, Eisenhower identified On War as the book that had most profoundly influenced his military career. Again, Eisenhower didn't have to do any of this. he chose to. One can imagine on the days and nights leading up to June 6, 1944, when Eisenhower successfully led the single largest and most important invasion in military history on the coast of Normandy. We can imagine him finding confidence in the lessons he had learned in Connor's library. One can imagine Marcus Aurelius doing the same with Epictetus and Rusticus in his tent late at night on the front lines of the war in Germania. We should be sobered and inspired by these examples. Reading, particularly when you're young, is not just some fun diversion. It may well be preparing you for a future you cannot even imagine. The mentorships you cultivate today, the people you seek out and listen to, are not just helping you advance in your career. They are part of your hero's journey. They are making you into the person you can be that the world may someday need. So that's your challenge today and every day, to find those books, to find your Rusticus and your Fox Connor, and most importantly, to do what they say. For me, this my sort of Fox Connor and my Rusticus has been Robert Greene. Robert Greene is the person who introduced me to many, many of the books that you've heard me recommend over the years. He taught me how to be a reader. And so actually our Read to Lead challenge, which we made with Daily Stoic, is largely influenced by some of the ideas from Robert Greene. So I strongly suggest you check that out. If you want to be a better reader, if you want to develop this kind of course of study for yourself, you can check that out at dailystoic.com/reading. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. Today's guest is actually someone I've wanted to have on the podcast for a very long time. I've reached out a million times to their publisher. I thought it was going to happen, then COVID happened, and then kept going back and forth. Then it just went nowhere. And then randomly, I got a Twitter DM from the person herself saying, "Hey, I would love to come on your podcast sometime. Would you ever want to have me on?" And I said, "Are you kidding? I've been trying to have you on forever. I've loved both of your books." And that is today's guest. I don't know what this says about publicists at publishers or just the importance of timing, but I'm so glad I got to make this happen, because my guest today, Kate Bowler, is one of my favorite authors. Actually, as I talk about in the interview, my sister is the one who turned me on to this, because Kate wrote an amazing piece in the New York Times where she talks about Seneca and grief and dying and her cancer diagnosis. And that's also the topic of her two wonderful books. Her first book, a New York Times bestseller, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. It's an awesome book. I read it when it first came out. I sell it at my bookstore, The Painted Porch. It's very popular. People love it. Here is my copy. And then her new book, which I just finished, No Cure for Being Human and Other Truths I Need to Hear. If these two memoirs weren't enough, Kate is an associate professor of the history of Christianity at Duke Divinity School. She has a master's degree in religion from Yale Divinity and a PhD from Duke. She's an expert on the history of Christianity in America, and she's written two really, from what I hear, fascinating academic texts about the prosperity gospel and the role of pastors' wives. So she is both an expert and, I think, a philosopher in the truest Stoic sense, in that she is deeply experienced in life itself. She has a surprise diagnosis of bowel cancer, stage 4 bowel cancer, as a young woman in her 30s. It turns her life upside down, but in the process forces her to explore all the powerful, life-changing, beautiful ideas that she talks about in these two books, and brings her, of course, to Stoicism and thus to today's podcast. She and I hit it off. I'm so excited and proud of this interview. I think you're going to really like it. And Amy, my sister, if you're listening, I hope this is the first episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast that you actually like, and I'll talk to you soon. I was going to tell you, you're the first guest in however many hundreds there have been that my sister actually gives a shit about. So
I am deeply honored. It's honestly, Ryan, it's usually someone's mom. So I feel pretty good to be getting the sister bracket.
I do find that's like the highest praise you can get. Like, with someone will say that with one of my books, I'll be like, "How'd you hear about the book?" They'll be like, "Oh, my wife made me read it, or my husband made me read it." Because like, I only recommend like a small percentage of the stuff that I read to my wife. I'll recommend stuff to my friends all the time, but
who you don't care about, which this is what this podcast should be about, is like, what's going on with you and your friends, Ryan?
Well, it's like if you recommend something to your spouse and they hate it, you'll never hear the end of it.
Yeah, so. That's true. I do remember, oh my gosh, my poor husband, though, like he's like a very impatient reader, and he gets really frustrated by the most bizarre criteria. Like he'll hand a book back and be like, it had too many characters. I'm like, how is that? Why? It can't all just be Life of Pi, buddy. Like, it can't just be two people on a boat forever.
So, speaking of important questions, one thing that I was thrown for a loop about in your book that I needed to know more about immediately, what is marshmallow salad? Is that a Canadian thing?
Oh, but the things people can do with marshmallows is really upsetting. Yeah. If you're a Mennonite, you just look at any food thing and you're like, that's not just a food. It's a food group. And it's not a food group. It's just something you're going to have to scale by about 200 or 300. So they take those mini marshmallows and they tend to be like, I bet this could use some mandarin orange wedges, but like the canned kind. Okay. And then it's just like, and then some green grapes, throw those in there. And then like a lot of just a lot of fluff gesture. And then sometimes Jello, and it is rough.
Is it rough. Like at barbecues? When do you serve marshmallow salad?
We don't have we don't really have any good reason to celebrate Thanksgiving in the way that you guys do, because we have no civil religion is what I'm reaching for. And so we do have a lot of Thanksgiving at a different time. We have it in October for entirely inexplicable reasons. Right. But when you visit our gentle and kind people, I would very much like to explain to you how bad food can be.
Okay. No, I guess we shove marshmallows into mashed potatoes on Thanksgiving for some reason. Oh, like they'll put it on top of yams or sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, but maybe it's a Thanksgiving thing. That makes sense.
This was like an full on, like that. That's your healthy side. Like you can have the carrots or you can have the marshmallow salad.
Right. Because it has salad in the name.
It's salad. Yeah. It's a variety. I think the one time that I was like the first time I broke ranks with my culture was I was at an outdoor like barbecue thing. And I saw that someone had put like slices of deli meat into the Jello salad.
What?
And I poked at it, like I shook at it first and then I poked at it. And then I stepped back from the line and I yelled, "Who did this? Take responsibility." And that felt right.
I have a memory, like I was working on my first book and we went to this like potluck thing or something. We were living in New Orleans and our friends had a friend who was like a Chinese exchange student who'd come over, and she made cookies, and she'd seen chocolate chip cookies, but she'd not had them before. And so she just thought it was like a cookie with things in it, and she didn't have chocolate chips. So she'd put beans in instead. And I took a bite of it, and apparently I made quite a scene that I then later had to apologize for.
That is so funny. Beans, that like the, just the consistency of that.
Well, no, and I feel like the exact phrase that you said would have come out of my mouth, which is, "Who did this? This is a crime against humanity."
Especially the texture. Yes. At first, you thought your mouth thought it was a raisin, and then it dug in a little more, and then the mealiness.
It looked like a chocolate chip cookie. Yeah, that was the worst part. It was so unsuspected.
Yeah, that's like in. I'm sorry, you're getting like full on. It's like a sleepover high brain where I've been, but like in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where it just gets Turkish delight. And it looks like something, but it tastes like nothing forever.
Well, we should talk about serious stuff.
Sure. Ryan, you're going to get a lot of unfiltered personality.
Well, as an easy transition, though, let's start with the absolute darkest question I have, which is, I was fascinated by this idea because it's something I think a lot about. You were sort of talking about as you're working, I suspect it was your first book, but you're talking about it in this one, where you're sort of like, why work on this thing if I'm going to die? Like, why spend time and energy on something that's as hard and to a certain degree unrewarding while you're doing it
as
a book? So What is the answer? Because I would love to know.
Well, yeah. And I knew how hard it would be writing a book like that. It was going to be a massive history book, like over 100,000 heavily footnoted words. Mm-hmm. And I knew how hard I was because I'd done it before. I'd written a massive history of the prosperity gospel, and that took me a decade. And then I realized, oh, this is probably my last fall. And this book will have to go in the early summer for what will probably be my last summer, for a job I'll never get to keep, for reasons that I now have to dig deep for. And it, at first the whole thing seemed absurd, really, truly absurd, because I'd always been so externally driven. I wanted to get tenure at an elite university. I wanted the feeling of the ladder that I was climbing. And then I got talked into it at a conference with two beautiful friends who do the same kind of work. And they said, you know, Kate, you've been kind of talking about this all wrong. You're always framing the historical work you do as like a result of your ambition or your, some kind of like quirky hobby at best. But, you know, even if the worst happens, like you're in there, like they, like the people who love you can find you there.
Sure.
And I guess the way that kind of resonated for me was that, that there's like a deep purity to doing something you know you were made to do. Mm-hmm. And I happen to believe that ideas bear up the weight of civilization, and they don't have to be mine, but I do think that idea work, which is like, especially I love the work of deep history, is inherently valuable, and that I happen to be good at it, but that only about 500 people read those books. So that was the math equation I ran, but it came out to a feeling of deep calling.
Did it change your relationship with the work, the sort of transition from external motivation to intrinsic, I might not even be around to experience the rewards motivation?
Yeah. I think I had to figure out too, if it could even fit in the course of a day, because what I was imagining was a mountain of work. And I was going to, in a way, have to be like in full beast mode to do it, so that I would have to get up 2 hours earlier. I'd have to know exactly how many words a day. I would have to slog and then toggle fast, where I could put it down, turn toward momming a little smushy baby,
right,
and then not being a dick to my family and friends, you know, like having enough left to then also be doing almost full-time like chemo, immunotherapy, sad cancer things. And so, but the beautiful feeling was the second I'd done it in the day, I used to send it to my dad, who's also a historian, and then he would read it over and we would sort of chew over little bits of things. But the feeling then of having that shared work where someone's kind of keeping pace beside you, that felt like we were digging out like a deeper part even of being together. So it wasn't then just intellectually satisfying. It felt like I was not alone, and being able to simultaneously make it like a gift, like a family project.
Sure. And when the sort of looming specter of death diminishes slightly, does that go away, or were you able to carry it forward on these two books?
I find death is very weird. Not that I've really fully been there, but I've almost been there a couple times. And it's almost like it's almost like volume dials. Like the volume of some things gets turned way up, and then other, it just feels very dreamy and far away. So that, and for me, work has always helped me kind of adjust the dials of my life. So I had to spend so much time in the hospital, and I just didn't want to, I knew I had to be there. Like, you have to get blood work done. You have to be nice to your nurse. Not everyone has to force their nurse to pretend to be a vampire, but that's what I did, and pretended he wanted to be left alone with my blood. And that's what I needed to get through those days. But I also wanted to be somewhere else and still myself. So I used to conduct interviews all the time in the cancer center.
Wow.
And have people stop by for my new, I had hundreds of people to interview for that dumb book.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, I'm really busy. You should come on by. But it was so lovely to see the way people are truly themselves while in the midst of you being truly yourself. So anyway, so that was very intense and felt really meaningful. But then what? Like, what do you do if you kind of have more time to spend? And I realized that I think I realized I needed to toggle between a couple different ways of being, that I needed to write to tell the truth, which was the beauty of being able to write like memoir and cultural essays.
Sure.
But then the other bit was I needed to write to learn. And so that I would keep flipping back and forth between those kinds of writings just so I could learn how to keep living, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been trying to think about that because I wrote one book during the pandemic. I did one book and a children's book, but it did feel like, especially in the summer of 2020, when things were really crazy, it was this sort of unique period of sort of stillness and quiet where it felt like the volume was turned down, but then the stakes were turned up, and then you weren't expected to do anything. So it sort of like was like waking up like on a Sunday every day, just and if you made progress, you were ahead because most people were not doing anything. And as I've been working on the next book since then, you know, everyone's sort of talking about things going back to normal. I'm not sure if I really want them to go back to normal. Mm-hmm. Whatever that was felt better to me than normal.
Yeah. Did you like the, I'm just wondering if it felt like that deep end feeling, like you can, like in the arc of a day, you can kind of dive deep under the water.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And like, there was so much less to say no to because most of the stuff you have to say no to was like illegal, you know, like temporarily, like coffee or travel or whatever. Like, you know, I've flown a couple times in the last month, the sort of first travel I've done since the pandemic for work stuff. And it's like, oh, I can't, I'm used to working where I'm not doing anything and nothing's going on. Yeah. And now I'm having to adjust to a sort of a busier world. I imagine that as traumatic and terrible as cancer was, it was a bubble, like literally and figuratively, where you were just, that was your life and everything else in the external world, you just didn't have time for.
I think the thing I was most scared of those is the beauty of the world you're describing, where the bubble lets you go deep, like deep into work or deep into love. And like there was and is living with chronic cancer is like the feeling of just being so like desperately in love with the world, mm-hmm. and not wanting to miss it.
Because it could go away. You have a sense of its ephemerality.
The precarity of it does feel very bright.
Yeah.
But a lot of cancer is, and a lot of pain or suffering is not just deep. It's horrifyingly mind-numbingly mundane. It's feeling foggy and being mad at yourself for feeling sleepy. It's being worried about being medically bankrupt because this is a country that bankrupts sick people.
Sure.
It was fighting with insurance companies over bills that were, so that was the, like, that wasn't just like the dross. Sometimes the suffering, I think most of suffering turns out it's just paperwork.
Yeah.
That feels
Kafka-esque.
Yes, exactly. That feels like just such a punishment. Like, wait, this is my existential finish line. I want to be doing the stuff that matters. And instead I'm talking to Linda from HR to see why this bill came to me.
No, that was something that my sister sort of told me about that I didn't think about. It's just like how long you have to spend in the hospital. That, you know, chemotherapy doesn't take 20 minutes. It takes like an hour of setup, and then it takes 2 hours, and then it's an hour of this, and then you can't drive, and then the next 2 days you're like, the idea that it involves so much waiting, I don't think is something people would anticipate.
Yeah. What does your sister do?
She works in education, but she had breast cancer about 3 years ago.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. She's doing good now, but the idea of just like, yeah. And then also, I guess the hell of the logistics of like, who's going to drive me. And you talk about this in the book, just the flights. And I could, the anger you felt when you were like, oh, I could have been doing it at Duke this whole time.
Yes. Yeah. When my life became a clock, I didn't really take too kindly to people wasting it.
Right.
And especially when, you know, I'm a professor at Duke University.
Right.
So when I found out that Duke University Hospital was offering the treatment I would need to live, I was so confused. I guess because turns out we're not just suffering, we're participating in this bigger thing called biocapitalism, and we're like caught in structures. And I think that's part of what makes you have to give up heroic individualism as a patient pretty fast is you're like, oh, there's me and the dignity of my many choices. Yeah. and then you realize, oh no, I'm in a trial, and the trial has rules, and the rules have sponsors, and there's a whole lot of things deciding what the next few months and years of my life will be, and it's not me.
Yeah, you're like the private in a mass army, and they're sending you around, and they don't really, this isn't about individuals at all. And so but to you, you are an individual, and in the primacy of your life and death struggle, you're the most important individual.
I like trying so hard to live this hero's journey, but instead I'm just like this sad peon who's like, does anyone just the cupbearer for all of these? I think that's what's so hard when so much of what I was trying to do is give up on this hyper agency that I'd gotten so hooked on. And I did not like being subject all the time to the things I couldn't pick. It does not suit my personality, and I did not enjoy it.
But that there's some irony, I guess, in that, because obviously as a Christian, but you talk about everything happens to a reason. Part of Christianity is about surrender. So, but then, and we can talk about that in the abstract, but then when surrender means Linda from HR is in charge, that's a different pill to swallow.
Well, especially lovingly and respectfully about Americans, but like American culture, especially American Christianity, is obsessed with individualism, telling and shaping their own faith story. I mean, not even our Calvinists aren't even Calvinists anymore. Everybody believes that they're, I mean, since everyone drank from the deep wells of the revolution, everybody is positive that they are rugged individualists bootstrapping their way to a different story. And in faith, that has had some really strange consequences for Christianity. Is faith became a set of certainties that people take on. Eventually it became a belief that I mean, try telling anybody in church that if you become a Christian, your life might actually get worse. It's absolutely countercultural.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, like the paradox of faith is that it's about belief, but then that becomes certainty, or that has sort of metastasized into a kind of certainty that doesn't leave a lot of room for other people to have different beliefs or situations.
Well, yeah, I think that the math that starts to get run is a kind of obsessive futurism. So because in this story that Jesus's death and resurrection saves the world, God is drawing us toward a story of love in which all things will be made right. And then therefore, and so it goes like, and then therefore, you know, heaven makes today not just bearable, but it makes it impossible then for you to complain. Or if you say, you know, I'm really scared, like I'm really scared right now. Then like, oh, God didn't give us a spirit of fear. So right. The futurism becomes a huge burden for people who are just trying to say that the life takes more courage than we expected. And I think like in the balance, here's my guess about me and you, Ryan. My guess is you and I agree a lot about courage. My guess is we disagree about hope. But I think that in this version, that the people who are especially hopeful are obsessed with a future that I'm asking them to give up a little bit of certainty about.
Interesting. Well, our mutual friend Seneca says that hope and fear are the same, which I think is an interesting way of thinking about it.
Tell me more.
Well, that they're both sort of about what the future will be, mm-hmm. some sense either of dread of the future or certainty about the future or expectation for the future, instead of dealing with that kind of painful ambiguity of the present moment or an uncertain future.
Yeah. 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 I love that. I love the framing of the existential cliff that Stoicism is so good at. I think it rubs against our culture's, I'm trying to pick a nicer word than delusional, excited, anticipatory, habits about always saying that life is supposed to get better.
Yes.
And just to be able to say, we don't know what the future will hold, and we have to learn how to live with under the burden of that with a little bit more humility, I think.
Well, you talk about that in the book, specifically about the Stoics. You're talking about how they lived in a time of cholera and smallpox and executions and exile and all of that. So it is interesting that then they spent a whole bunch of time going memento mori or remember, you know, Seneca talks about never forgetting fortune's habit of behaving exactly as she pleases. So it's weird that people who lived in an uncertain world where tragic, terrible things were happening all the time, certainly at a level greater than it is today, right? Like you're not getting exiled, you know, even if you're canceled, it just means you don't have a Twitter account or something anymore, right? So like the stakes are so much lower, and yet we don't do any of that. It's weird that they had to do the reminding when the stakes were there and visceral and real. Yeah. And then today, when it's actually much more likely that you would be caught by surprise by one of those things because it's not happening to your neighbor, we're like, oh, I'm fine. Yeah. I'm prepared. And you're not, I don't think anyone's prepared.
Yeah, I totally agree. Also, I loved how excited you were when you said that. I don't know. This is all the stuff that nobody likes when I say at parties. So I like how excited that you are to say it at this party.
Yes, yes. No, it's like, you know, people used to, like you would, the average person would lose 1 to 2 children in childbirth. Yeah. And yet, you know, the Stoics are talking about, you know, even thinking about your children's mortality. And then today that's not happening. And we're not taking the time, like, life isn't reminding you of it, except in these sort of freak instances, or, you know, you're a surprise case for cancer. Mm-hmm. You get basically old man's cancer. And so, of all the people who should be actively preparing, it's us, but we don't do it.
Yeah. And I should have been, I mean, you would think with an expertise, like, I study the history of people's ideas about suffering and whether their lives are going to get better. You'd think that someone who'd written for 10 years on that would be slightly less surprised, but I was horrified. I was horrified that it was me. I was horrified that it was my life that came apart. It was awful to be the one that felt like I was just a bomb that went off. But I think had I lived, 100 years before, I kept thinking about my, especially in this plague that we've just been going through, I just keep thinking how short our historical memory is. Like, my grandparents knew. My grandma had been sent away to a sanitarium with tuberculosis, and she was, the smartest person in their family, was just about to do what no one else had done in my family and get a college degree. And she suddenly catches this wildly infectious errant disease, and she's put behind glass. And even when she miraculously is allowed to leave, they had to cut out most of the tissue of her lung. And she spent the rest of her life in and out of quarantine, basically having to put her own children in the foster care system when she couldn't care for them. And I think, man, my grandma knew. It was just my parents forgot, and then I forgot. Right.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
You know, Seneca has tuberculosis too. He has to spend 10 years basically in Egypt convalescing. And it's right as he basically becomes a lawyer, gets tuberculosis, has to spend 10 years. He comes back, reinvents himself as a politician. Then he gets exiled, spends another 10 years. So yeah, it is interesting. We talk about like things going back to normal, and it's like, actually, this stuff is very normal. Yes. This is like, show me some decade or some human life long enough where this stuff doesn't happen. I mean, exactly 100 years ago. Yeah. We had the Spanish.
Exactly. Food. Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And even, I mean, I'm an American historian. And I mean, when I was giving my sort of like the big lecture series, I didn't even include the history of plagues because I don't think I imagined. I was mostly trying to tell the story about democracy and choice and the idea of Americans' concept of self-making. I really wish I would have told the history as its equal and opposite, is the story of our fragile selves.
Right.
The story of our desperate attempts to control what can't be controlled, and how very quickly we forget, especially when we get all, you know, whipped up on our certainties.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, reading the Stoics, like I'd read Marcus Aurelius probably 100 times, and it never
actually resonated with me that he was not only living in a plague, but he writes about the plague several times.
Yeah.
Like I guess I just assumed. So there's one passage that I've talked about a lot, so people are probably tired of hearing about it. But he says, you know, there's two types of plagues. He's like, there's the plague that takes your life. And he says, but the much more dangerous pestilence is the one that destroys your character. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. He's being whatever. I didn't get that he was talking about exactly what we've seen play out on the news for 18 months. Like it just never occurred to me that he could be specifically talking about people and the plague that he was living in. And then, yeah, you just sort of get caught by surprise by it. It's kind of strange, the tunnel vision that we get.
I think I had maybe thought about cancer in a similar way, because I really didn't know anybody. Nobody in my family had cancer. There was no sense that I was genetically predisposed to anything. Sure. And so I assumed it was a thing that unlucky people get. Don't know why.
Right.
But it felt, but the more that I have spent time with people who study cancer, and I did this one, a lovely conversation with the pioneer of bad luck theory in cancer, which was this, and I will, as a historian and not a scientist, struggle to summarize this appropriately, but his name is Christian Tomasetti, and he's a professor at Johns Hopkins, and he had this thought on an airplane, an epiphany, that that people had not been able to appropriately predict the incidence rate of cancer. So how many people get kidney cancer versus how many people who get bone cancer? And he wondered if, as a statistician, it might have something to do with the rate of cell replication per organ. What an interesting and elegant thought. And so then he decided to map the number, the incidence of cancer with the rate of growth of cells. Mapped it amazingly. It maps beautifully. And he then, so when I'm sitting there with stage 4 stupid colon cancer, and I had been so desperate for a reason for it. I had been like hungry for a reason, because frankly, everywhere I went, people blamed me for it. Like it's different than brain cancer. 'Cause if you have colon cancer, you assume you get all the people who, you know, all the goop people, right? All the essential oil smoothie people. And
It was what you were eating. It's something in the air. It's the environmental, or it's somebody's fault.
It's probably mine. And didn't I, you know, always just like a deep curiosity, as if I'm like sleeping next to a mattress factory every day, and drinking directly from the environmental.
Right.
And I am. And when I guess I had been struggling honestly with, just this like hyper causality that happens when you suffer. Why?
Sure.
And also I had recently had a nurse blame me for what I'd eaten on the way into like a recent procedure or something. She looked at my chart and she was like, well, must be something you ate. And I was like, all right, well, I'm in a hospital gown. I'm feeling a little tender right now. Maybe you could stop tacitly calling me fat. But when the researcher, Christian Tomasetti, he looked at me and he goes, oh, well, Kate, I mean, cells duplicate and cells in the colon duplicate at a higher rate. So my dear, there's not necessarily like a reason. You're just deeply unlucky. And when I started thinking about cancer cells being, you know, cells that try to fix themselves, cells that try to duplicate, of just living inside of chance itself, I felt like I was able to accept the chaos of it in a way that I don't think I would have been able if he hadn't joyfully pronounced me deeply unlucky.
So what's the difference between being deeply unlucky and everything happens for a reason? It's the same nonsense, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, I've only read a little bit about the history of luck, but it really all depends if you've applied like a, it's almost like I think of it as if you've, if you're living in a closed universe or not.
Okay.
Like if you're living under a, like a, not an open sky, a closed ecosystem, in which every single thing like karma has to either come back to you in some way or another, every action gets a reaction, then everything has to be overly hyperinterpreted. And I think depending on your theory of luck, one of the lovely explanations is that it's not an explanation at all, is that something surprising happens and it has a happy outcome. You're lucky. But neither of those things are a story about your character or a story about, and right. Sometimes they are, but allowing there to be a little bit more ambiguity there is like something I really do a lot of work around, because it's like a deep hope I have that it'll make us more charitable, I think.
But even in, so even unlucky is a bit of a story then, right? It's just that was just your luck, right? Like probabilistically, it can happen. So it did happen. And that's why you're in the mess you're in.
It does get a little pluriverse with theories of luck, because it really kind of depends on whether or not you've decided what the rules of the game are. Like, for instance, one theory of luck is that when a system operates the way it should, you're not lucky. You're just, you know, it's the natural outworking. So, for instance, you could just be, if you, you know, if I'm an affluent white person entering a healthcare in a certain position and it works to my advantage, I'm not lucky. It's just the outworking of the system and the way it's designed. But in this, because I study religious causality, I guess part of the burden has been in being like an overinterpreted person. Like I'm always like a spiritual problem to be solved, or
this is how people are seeing you.
Because I can't, otherwise if what happened to me was just random, then it might happen to them.
Or they might have to, like, let's say it's a, I think this is a problem we have politically in the United States with, you know, some of the issues that we obviously have to solve, whether it's like, let's say mass shootings. If you can respond to this with everything happens to a reason or thoughts and prayers, then you don't have to address it. Right. And so I think you were talking about some of the inequities in the healthcare system, or the fact that you can be bankrupted for the bad luck of having cancer. If this is just something that can happen to someone and that it happens with an alarming amount of regularity, then we have to do something about it. If it's God's will, then we can just feel bad for that person and not have to change. And that's the thing I think people struggle with, even with Stoicism, this idea of like what's in our control, what's not in our control. Yeah. That doesn't mean that you just look at all the horrible things happening in the world and you go, glad it's not me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the courage to act. I hear that.
Or the courage to actually sit and wrestle with the discomfort of bad things happen to good people, and that could happen to me.
Ryan, we don't want to live in reality, though. Wouldn't we? What a terrible idea. These are awful. You must be terrible at kids' birthday parties.
Yes. I would say one of the upsides of the pandemic has been fewer kids' birthday parties.
Yeah. What do you mean? Standing near strangers, watching children blow on food.
Not having to do 7 one day, the back to back to back. I've enjoyed that. So talk me through your introduction to the Stoic, because that's actually how I found you. My sister had sent me an article that you'd written in the New York Times about your cancer diagnosis, where you talked about Seneca, I believe. So how does that introduction happen?
Well, I was being talked out of it by my lovely colleague, Warren. So I teach at I'm at Duke University's. Wonderful do-gooders who lead local congregations. And I was really struggling with the idea that the future just felt, I mean, I could hear it in the way that I couldn't talk, I couldn't speak casually anymore with people. They'd always say, oh, we should do that in the summer, or like, let's go to, or even just like complaining about, oh, it'll be years until I'd ever get to retire. Like, we're all 12 years old.
Right.
And I could feel it like catch in my throat. And I knew that I didn't sort of belong to the future anymore.
You were dealing with different time horizons than everyone else.
Yeah. 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 And it felt, it felt like I was locked out of a world that I had once very casually visited. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm trying to remember the exact phrase, but I was talking to my adorable friend Warren, who like is forever in a clerical collar. Just like it's like a, like I've seen him come out of the gym. I don't even understand where he keeps it. And I was like, Warren, do you think that that he could tell I was really? I said I think I'd like to give up on the future. And he said, well, would you agree that like to live is to live without the like an anxious dependent on like what is to come, something like that. And I was like, yes, wait, is this a trap? Please tell me that Jesus said this. And he was like, oh no, that was Seneca. And he was like, but we Christians are meant to be people of hope. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. The future, the future is like an abyss. And I guess I was trying to, you know, I'm not an expert in, I only have, I'm going to like have to, I'd have to rummage through my philosophy minor in my undergrad to like be any good at this, though I did learn Latin and was not bad at it for a bit. But I was trying to figure out the nature, like what is the nature of Christian hope if hope isn't optimism? I'd spent so long studying the history of positive thinking and I really couldn't figure out what the, frankly, Rand, I couldn't figure out what the difference was. Sure. So that's what I was struggling through.
Interesting. Yeah. You know what? One of the things that really struck me a couple of years ago was realizing that Seneca and Jesus are both born in roughly the same year, both in provinces of the Roman Empire, both ultimately die. One dies a little later than the other, but both die sort of at the hands of the state. And then both probably are more impactful after their death than during their death or during their life. But it is weird to think like these two guys were walking around the earth at the same time, saying relatively similar things.
I, you know, there's like, it's such a, and there's such a meld, like for centuries, there's like the impact of Stoicism on Christianity was significant. I think obviously one believes that a guy died and then was the only person to get resurrected really, and then stay resurrected.
Yes.
Sorry, Lazarus. And that resurrection tells us something about the salvation of the world. I guess the difference there is I think one of the similarities that I feel and I, is about the way that both Stoicism and Christianity have a lovely cyclical view of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has a,
it's a circle, you say in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, it doesn't just, well, I'd love to hear your thoughts and feelings of our culture's current obsession with the be present mindset.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other two Stoicism Bible things, Seneca's brother's in the Bible, which I've always found to be really interesting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his brother is Gallo, or Gallo. I don't know how you pronounce it. But and then if you told me that Marcus Aurelius was actually the author of Ecclesiastes, I would buy that.
Yeah.
They're basically the same.
It's a got real vibe.
Yeah. No, I think the present thing is interesting because there's almost like a certain emptiness to it, you know, like the Zen idea of presence, like you have no self, think nothing, just be present. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's that meaningful or I don't know. There's almost something nihilistic I found in that, in the sort of Zen approach. To me, I like the idea of just very much breathing the present moment in, like seeing the world like the way that an artist or a child would see the world, which is that it's perfectly sufficient. It's wonderful as it is, even when it's ugly, even when it's mundane, and to not need it to be anything different than it is. To me, that's where you want to get, which is when you just say be present isn't quite capturing what we're talking about.
Yeah. It sounds like you're arguing for a deeper acceptance and a more, and a, the granularity of reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk in my stillness book, I talk about Maria Abramovic, and she does this, that art installation where she sits in a chair every day for like 50 consecutive days.
Yes.
And like, as she's sitting there, people will, you know, they would rotate, people would come. And like, you watch some people like sit across from her and she has said and done nothing. And they just burst into tears. Just the being in the presence of someone who is present was almost more than they could bear. And I found that to be very poignant.
Yeah. You always know, don't you?
When
like, and I
old people have that vibe very often. It's the grandparent vibe.
Yes, totally. It is like a deep magic, is being willing to be surprised and then changed by the people you actually encounter. That's a kind of, that started for me, I think, with my diagnosis, mostly because I couldn't, maybe because the future was taken away in such an intense way. And then I needed to be surprised in my day because the day wasn't sufficient.
I found during the pandemic, just a sort of an overwhelm of emotions of just like, this is sort of it. This is enough. Yeah. It's not going to be anything different. It could be like this forever. It could end tomorrow. Like life itself could end tomorrow. It was a sort of a weird feeling that I haven't been quite able to shake of just like,
yeah,
sort of really fully being engaged in life in a way that you're not when you're doing 50 things at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a, when life can't be wide and then just to make it deep, like just to keep letting the new details of it. I was in quarantine 9 times though, because of the government. I was in Canada and every time I was in quarantine 9 times though, Ryan. And I will tell you, on the 9th, I felt less in love with the details of my small student rental in Winnipeg, Manitoba, I'll tell you.
That's interesting. So we live out in the country and then decided to sort of take it very seriously and just never, because I don't have to see anyone for work and neither does my wife. We just sort of have been on one long quarantine, like sort of ever since. And so it was really sort of surreal and beautiful, but that was something I was going to ask you. So when you have this sort of, you talked about the volume being turned down and the volume being turned up on some stuff, but then as you come out of the diagnosis or into the remission or whatever the sort of weird thing they call it for you.
I know. I'm not even cancer. It's not even remission. I'm just sort of like, I now pronounce you cancer-y.
You're good for now.
Yeah. I'm cancer adjacent.
How do you like, cause I've been struggling with this, like on the couple, like, there was stuff I agreed to when it was like hot vac summer and we thought life was going back to normal. And then now it's like a little weird, especially here in Texas. But like I've been having trouble doing mundane things that are part, like it's like I'm supposed to miss bedtime for this fucking conference call, or like I have to go to the DMV. Like, how could someone steal 1 hour of my time for such a how do you go back to just regular life?
Yeah. That's right.
That's a thing. Yeah. How have you adjusted?
I love this. You're right. Because there is kind of a brittleness to it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, fuck you. I'm being existential right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. She said as a Christian. Yeah. I guess it did sort of help me when my friend Luke was in his work. He like talks about different kinds of experiences of time, and that basically just describing to me that the one in which I've been living was tragic time. That like there's a, you know, which was, we've all been in the pandemic, that the stakes have been elevated, the both gratitude and intensity of the todays and the yesterdays become kind of overwhelming. And also like an overlap, but not always related, is like apocalyptic time. I mean, I hope we've all read accounts of people who believed that the very end of the world was on them, and that they had stark binaries that they imagined, and that gave them a kind of crisp clarity about what they what was intolerable and what they would give everything to have in their lives, you know. And then there's just ordinary time, and
that's the pastoral time.
Yeah, that's just the garbage getting up and then figuring out whether your bread has gone moldy for your nice toast, and And then, you know, caring about other people, returning phone calls, and then
right
giving up on self-mastery for the moment. And I find I have such a deep, I mean, I think, Ryan, this is why we have like a secret and immediate friend assumption, at least on my part, is like a deep and deep and a deep intolerance of ordinary time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't tell me what to do.
Yeah. No. And I think I got very used to having no ordinary time over the last 18 months. And now you're like, what do you mean the flight is 30 minutes delayed? Like, you're stealing this from me and my children, and we'll never get this back. You know,
Ryan, I love that so much. You are robbing me of my lifeblood, which just to say my minutes. And yeah, the tick, tick, tick feeling, I really, I feel that so deeply because I have wanted so desperately to turn all my minutes into moments. And then when people want to change them back, like Cinderella pumpkin style, back into these garbage minutes.
Yeah,
I feel you. I mean, because at first when I knew that my minutes, like when you said, did you say Rob stolen? You said stolen from me.
Yeah.
I was like, you can't take this from me.
Right.
I stood up in the middle, it was a couple months after my diagnosis, everyone sort of thought I was ready for polite company. Turns out I wasn't.
Right.
I would like stand up in the middle of work lunches and announce, I don't have time for this.
Yeah.
I like rented heavy machinery just to bulldoze things out of sheer joy. I was recently, I promise this is just not related to anything, but poisoned by a copperhead snake. And I was in the hospital being—
Wait, you got bit by a copperhead?
I sure did.
I saw a coral snake this morning. It was very exciting on our morning walk. But so how did it get close enough to bite you?
Well, please don't get bitten because it'll cost you $120,000.
Yeah,
which is the anti-venom. Mm-hmm. I was a block from my house, like a saint moving a half step off a path for an old man onto a fully mowed bit of grass. Wow. And then I guess stepped on where it was probably living and having a nice day. And then it bit me and it really hurt, is like a not surprising subplot of that scenario, but it also meant that I got to walk into a hospital, yell, I've been poisoned, which was one of the funniest things I've ever gotten to say. But while I was stuck in the stupid hospital, I was like, you are robbing me of my Tuesday. And I was high, but I did apparently send a very thoughtful email to somebody asking if they worked with, I was like, I think I remember that you worked with sharks. And then like cut to 2 weeks later, I'm like fishing dinosaurs out of the ocean because I don't like having things be taken
right
from me. And I hear you.
Wow. What happened?
I like,
you have a motion sensor?
Lighting? I do. I also just thought we just might want a little drama.
You write these sort of books about, you know, that appeal to people in times of difficulty, and you sort of never know who they're going to reach. One of the weird experiences for me with the Daily Stoic is somebody gave Billy Bush a copy of the book, like as his life was imploded and destroyed for a tape that, you know, he basically forgot existed. And, you know, he was not the bad guy on the tape. But
he was kind of the bad guy.
No, I mean, Billy Bush took the weight for our anger at a different person. Right. Yeah. But anyway, so he loses his job and his livelihood and his reputation. And then he was telling me like 3 weeks later, he's like playing golf with his friends and his friend like drills him in the head with a golf ball, like off of a drive. Like he nearly dies from that. And it is weird how we think that life is as bad as it could possibly be.
Yeah,
and then it manages to get worse. Yeah, then you get bit by a copperhead.
Ryan, I'm going to just say this as an aside so that you can fully cut this because you won't want to include it. But Billy Bush absolutely immediately tweeted that everything had happened for a reason and that he had been taught a lesson by his complicity. Complicity was the word he should have used. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's not the right lesson. But I bet he hadn't read your book yet. And so I would have liked to meet him after he read your book. Okay.
Let's Well, let's actually leave it in, because my favorite part of the book is the appendix where you translate what we should say instead of that. So I'll let him know that it's not everything that happens for a reason. It says we must learn to face uncertainty with courage, which I love that, right? It's not that it happened for a reason. It's that shit happens and you got to figure out how to navigate through it. Sometimes that shit is your fault. Sometimes it's partly your fault. Sometimes you're not to blame at all.
Yes, that's right. Yes, absolutely.
Why do you think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I think people gravitate towards those cliches because they do kind of explain things, but they're also woefully insufficient at the same time. And I do wonder if, like, if you ever actually heard one of the Stoics say one of these things to you at the time, you'd be like, shut the fuck up. Like, that is woefully insufficient to the tragedy of my current situation.
I do think that this, it's part of the beauty and the weight of you can say time worn truths or you can say cliches, but it's that there's always a little gem in there. Like the beauty of being present is you and I agree that people are magic and that if you slow down that time unspools, and that's a weird trick to learn. I think YOLO is a great idea, except of course, if you need to, you know, pay taxes or like
a career,
bear the weight of other people's loves and dreams too.
Sure.
Like there's, you know, several hundred thousand people right now who are not living their dreams. They're living the dreams of other people by being a caregiver. So we're not all just self-realizing.
Yes. You know,
existential hunger monsters.
My favorite one from Seneca that I think about that sort of changed my thinking. And I wonder what your thoughts would be. He says, don't think of death as something in the future. He says, think of death as something that's happening always, like it's happening right now. So like the time that passes belongs to death is basically what he says.
That is nice and dark. Yeah. I like a good crispy darkness.
And so this idea, like, instead of like, like I have 40 years left, it's like, how many years have you lived?
I'm 40 years spent. Yeah.
Yes. And that seems to me an interesting way to think about it, because it's also in our control, right? Like if we go back to the idea of being present, the time you have now, you can choose to live it or not live it, or just let it elapse. Whereas you don't really have control over when the end comes.
Yeah. Yeah. Control really is a drug, and I have loved it.
With your lists and things?
I love my lists. I love my light feeling of wind in my sails. I love the feeling of being on stilts, you know, like your steps just, but having most of that taken away and still having like what things remain, you know? And unfortunately it is like the deep and beautiful love of others and being a group project. And we all know we hated group projects in high school. So someone's always like, someone who did B minus work is always getting an A plus.
Yes, your family members are not contributing to the group project as
yeah,
much as
I want to name them right now. Let's get into it. Let's get specific. Who failed me during cancer?
Last thing, because I do think it's interesting to actually hear you, because you can, when you read the books, it's very clear that you have a sense of humor and that you're fun, and that's partly what gets you through this. But I think there is this idea, at least particularly of the Stoics, but I suspect of Christians too, that sort of the study of philosophy, these big ideas, sort of sucks the joy out of everything or sucks the humor out of it. But all the priests that I remember liking growing up were hilarious. And like, I think the Stoics are really funny too. Why is there this idea that this is all like very deadly serious and there's no fun in it?
Yeah. Well, partly the ponderous tone we probably use while quoting, but I think the reason why they're funny is because tragedy. I mean, because it's tragedy.
Yeah.
It's like humor and drama and comedy and, I mean, it is like, it is the deep comedy of our lives.
Better to laugh than cry.
And laughing, I mean, really, it helps us tell the truth. It really does. I mean, we all know the person who will say it in a group, and that person, and like, that is, it is, it's because we need to practice getting up as close to the edge of the cliff as possible. And imagining we have wings for a moment, which is what comedy does, like helps us feel the upward draft of the air and not just hold our breath.
That's beautifully said. Well, I loved the new book. I loved the other one, which I also read. And I hope there are many more to come.
Ryan, you are such a philosophy nerd, and I love it so much. I would absolutely have been your best friend in college.
Remember, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave is now available everywhere. You can go to your local bookstore and pick it up. You can come to the Painted Porch and pick it up. We are still offering the pre-order bonuses. We've extended it to the end of this week. So you can get that at dailystoic.com/pre-order. But you can also get Audible. You can get eBooks. You can get whatever you want from wherever you want it. But I would very much like you to support the new book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.